Looking up there, I see myself saying repeatedly, the most difficult thing at MIT is to create an environment where we can have conversations. And I guess I've decided now that maybe I need to change my mind. The most difficult thing at MIT is to get people to sit in the center down close so that we can actually see one another. Or to get them here at 7 o'clock. I suspect, knowing MIT as I do, that we'll have people coming in through the next few minutes, James, and that's the way it is. It has nothing to do with you. I've actually had circumstances where I've had a completely empty auditorium at 5 minutes to the hour and had it completely filled at 5 after. We may not do that here tonight, but we could come close. It's really a pleasure this evening to have Chaplain Yi with us. It's a pleasure to sponsor this program. It is important work that we're doing as we carry on conversations across the boundaries that cultures and societies would impose upon us. We have much to learn from each other. I tell people here at the Institute that if you want to see diversity in the university, the place to go is to prayers on Friday in W11 or Catholic Mass on Sunday. That these religious communities represent the most diverse communities on this campus. And we sell ourselves short when we don't understand the dimensions of diversity that our religious communities bring to us. And if we say that we value that as an institution, as an educational institution, it behooves us to be aware of that. So it's my pleasure to have James Yi with us. His story is outlined in the brochure you received as you came in. It is a story that has been repeated too often in American history. But the good news is that sometimes, given time and the emergence of good sense, we actually can get things right. And having him here to tell his story, to share it with us, and to answer questions and to converse with you is part of that process. James, it's a delight to welcome you here. You can fill in the details of your biography if you wish. If not, you all can ask more questions later. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd just like to begin and start by saying that it's very much an honor and pleasure to be here today in Boston to share with you a little bit of my experience, but also to share with you some of the relevant issues that I think is going on today in our country with regard to American Muslims, and that's Islamophobia. But to begin, just let me give you a quick background of myself. I'm a third-generation Chinese-American. It was my grandparents who immigrated to the United States. Both of my parents, American-born. My dad turned 83 this year. All of my brothers and sisters, all born right here in the United States. I graduated West Point in 1990, so I have that military background. But not only did I graduate West Point and serve in the U.S. military, my younger brother also graduated West Point. My other brother also served the U.S. military, as today he's an Army doctor serving at Fort Hood. And my father, who I mentioned was a U.S.-born citizen, he too actually served in the U.S. Army when he was drafted during World War II. And also, I'm a Muslim convert. I converted to Islam back in 1991 after being raised Lutheran. And my journey to Islam, in and of itself, is a whole another story, a whole nother lecture, a whole nother presentation that perhaps one day I'll have the opportunity to share with you that as well. But today I want to talk mostly about this topic, Islamophobia. And right here, I just threw up some photos that I picked off the internet, which really kind of describes some of what is going on today in the United States. Just a couple weeks ago, the front cover of Time magazine was asking, you know, is America Islamophobic? And From my perspective, without a doubt, there are many, many people in our society who don't know much about Islam and Muslims who live here in the United States. And this is something that in the work that I do, I hope to change. I hope to educate people about who we are as a community in this country, American Muslims, and about my faith, the faith that I converted to. Real quickly, when we ask about Islamophobia and define it, you know, what is it? I look at it as this, an irrational fear and hostility towards Islam and Muslims. And that often leads to discrimination, profiling, hate crimes, violation of constitutional rights. I'll talk a little bit more about that with my own experience as the chaplain in Guantanamo. And also it leads to anti-Muslim rhetoric, which we hear in the media, on the airwaves, from elected officials and politicians. But essentially that's basically what it is, an irrational fear and hostility towards Islam and Muslims. This idea of Islamophobia, though, isn't something new. It's not something that happened after 9/11, when the tragic attacks occurred on that day, and really that word became more and more popular. But no, Islamophobia actually existed long before 9/11. In 1995, we can see here that when Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, when they carried out the Oklahoma City bombing, taking out the Alfred T. Murrow building, killing 168 people, that included 19 children under the age of 6. The first people, the first group that was suggested that may have been responsible for these attacks was the Muslim community. Media heavily suggested that these attacks were carried out by perhaps Muslim extremists, similar to what had happened in 1993 with the first World Trade Center bombing. But Muslims, of course, we know now, had nothing to do with these bombings. But still, there was backlash. And there were some things that didn't get widely reported after those attacks took place. Like, for example, a Jordanian-American who was in London was detained and then sent back home to the U.S. because it was said that, quote, he might have, quote, possible bomb-making equipment. Like what might be a cell phone that could be a possible detonator. Well, when the community in Oklahoma, the people in Oklahoma, found out that this guy had been detained, returned back home, his property was vandalized, his wife was even spat upon. In Oklahoma, after these attacks in 1995, there was a Muslim woman who was pregnant. She miscarried her late-term child when an angry mob attacked her house with stones and bricks. Right? There were plenty of death threats to Islamic centers and Muslim organizations. There were bomb threats. There were get out of the U.S. type phone calls that were made to Islamic centers and Muslim organizations in Oklahoma following these attacks. But again, Muslims had nothing to do with this bombing. There was even a report by INS, the immigration, which said that they were actually looking for, quote, Middle Eastern appearance type men. So this led into this idea that maybe Muslims are behind this attack on the federal building. But we do see a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric coming from elected officials. This is something that actually happened in the state that I was formerly living in, Washington, on the West Coast. What happened here back in 2003 was a prominent imam, Muslim religious leader, Muslim clergyman, was invited to the state legislature to open that day with an invocation. And this is my friend Imam Muhammad Joban from Indonesia. And when he gave his prayer, there were two elected officials, two representatives, state representatives, who walked out of that prayer. One of them was this woman here, Representative Lois McMahon. And when asked why she walked out, on this Muslim imam giving an invocation, her response was, it's an issue of patriotism. Meaning that it was her patriotic duty, or out of patriotism, that she would walk out on the prayer of a Muslim. The other individual who had walked out, when he was asked why he walked out of the prayer, he had responded by saying, well, Muhammad is not my God. Well, I never met that individual, but I would have informed him that Muhammad is not my God either, nor is it the God of Muslims. Muslims don't pray and worship to Muhammad. Many people don't know that. We worship one God, God the Almighty, the creator of heavens and earth. But this is out of ignorance and, again, this Islamophobia that we even find in our elected officials today. This congressional representative was quoted once in an interview by saying that in response to a question where he was asked what could the United States do if perhaps Muslims carried out a nuclear attack against our nation. One of the things he responded by was saying, well, we could take out Islamic holy sites, meaning bombing Mecca, for example. Essentially, in saying that, he's saying that, you know, all Muslims are these individuals who would carry out violence and attack the United States with a nuclear bomb. Back in 2006, our nation made, in my view, historic steps. When the state of Minnesota elected the first American Muslim to Congress, Mr. Keith Ellison from the 5th District of Minnesota. He was elected to the U.S. Congress in 2006. And when he was elected, one of the things he quickly made known was that he intended to take his oath swearing on the Holy Quran. A lot of Congress people, when they get elected, they swear on the Bible. Or some of the Jewish representatives will swear on, you know, the Torah or a Jewish Bible. Some don't swear on anything. Some swear on the Constitution. Representative Keith Ellison said, or representative-elect at that time, Keith Ellison said, he was going to swear on the Holy Quran. And that caused some controversy. A representative from Virginia, a congressman from Virginia, would come out and criticize him for doing that, or intending to do that. And that was Congressman Virgil Good. And he would say that Keith Ellison's desire to use the Quran during the swearing-in ceremonies was a threat to the values and beliefs traditional to the United States of America. Because he basically saw the United States as a nation that only includes Christian Judeo values. He would also say that, I fear in the next century we will have many more Muslims in the United States if we do not adopt strict immigration policies. Fearing Muslims, that Muslims would immigrate to the United States. Thankfully, Brother Keith Ellison was very crafty, was very clever in how he decided to carry out his swearing-in ceremony on the Quran. In fact, what he did was he went to the Library of Congress and he got the copy of the Quran that was owned by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson owned the copy of the Quran. And many people know that Thomas Jefferson's library, actually most of it was destroyed in a fire. But one of the books that did survive that fire was his copy of the Quran. And it's preserved today in the Library of Congress. Keith Ellison went to the Library of Congress and used that Quran to take his oath. And here we see that taking place with Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. On the radio waves, we hear shock jock commentators rattling anti-Muslim rhetoric all the time. I don't know if it's to raise ratings or if it's really their personal views, but this guy, Michael Savage, of this radio show, The Savage Nation, he would suggest things like, you know, to save the United States, our legislator, our Congress, they should essentially just outright ban Muslims from immigrating to our country, and that we should ban all construction on mosques. That idea of banning construction of mosques is something that actually in the last few weeks, the last couple of months, has actually really, in my view, taken some kind of hold in our country. And I'll talk more about that. In 2008, during the presidential campaign, there was Islamophobia, as many people tried to characterize then-Senator Barack Obama, candidate for the United States, as a Muslim in disguise, as if that was something dangerous, right? A Fox News anchor would say that when Barack Obama got up on stage and did that fist jab with his wife, he called it a terrorist fist jab, as if this is something that Muslims do, I don't know, or terrorists do, you know, I don't know. You know, I thought this was the fist jab. I thought that was something that was originated from who's that guy who does Deal or No Deal? Howie. You know, I thought that came from him. You know, on that show. And then, of course, that fist jab was satirized by the New Yorker, and this cover of New Yorker magazine in July of 2008 caused controversy. I mean, the New Yorker said that it was satire, that they were making humor out of this. Quote, terrorist fist jab, but a lot of people were offended when they, especially the Muslim community, when they tried to portray Barack Obama as a Muslim, as if that was something negative. But you know, sometimes some people have to step up and speak out, speak up on what's right. And one of the people who did that was Colin Powell. Interestingly enough, a conservative. A Republican. And when he endorsed Barack Obama, he did it by objecting to the idea of Islamophobia. You know, he answered the question as to, you know, Barack Obama maybe being a Muslim. Basically, Colin Powell said, you know, the right answer is, what if he is Muslim? Is there something wrong with being Muslim in this country, in the United States? Is there something wrong with a 7-year-old Muslim American kid believing that he or she can one day be president? Right? And then he would tell how he himself was moved emotionally when he saw the picture of a Muslim mother mourning over the death of her son who had died in war. And Colin Powell said, and his name was Karim Rashad Sultan Khan. And he was an American. And he gave his life. So he was pointing out that Muslims in this country are also paying the ultimate sacrifice. Some of them dying to protect the freedoms that we have here in this country. One of the things I sometimes point out is something that happened during that election campaign in upstate New York. If you happen to be someone who lived in Rensselaer County and voted by absentee ballot, this is the ballot you might have received. You know, the presidential ballot, it didn't say that you had the box where you can vote for Barack Obama, but it said Barack Osama. Now I would ask, was that just a typo? Or was there something else behind that? Yeah. But this is an actual picture of an actual ballot, the ballots that were sent out in upstate New York. Another person who recently stepped up in defense of religious freedom, in diversity, is the mayor of New York City, Mayor Michael Bloomberg. In August, when the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission unanimously voted 9-0 to allow the construction of an Islamic cultural center known as Park 51, a.k.a. the Ground Zero Mosque in New York City, Mayor Bloomberg came out and fully supported that. And he was in support of that even before the vote. And he would say on the day that they voted to approve the Muslims to be able to build this Islamic center, this community cultural center in Lower Manhattan, he would say this: "We will be untrue to the best part of ourselves and who we are as New Yorkers and Americans if we were to say no to a mosque in Lower Manhattan." He would continue and also state that Muslims are as much part of our city and our country as the people of any faith. And they are as welcome to worship in Lower Manhattan as any other group, as is their right. So he was supportive of Muslims' right to religious freedom and to build a mosque anywhere where they might own that property. But this idea of a ground zero mosque, of a community cultural center in Lower Manhattan, surely has caused controversy, as we've seen in the news over the past few weeks. Formerly now, it's called Park 51. Why Park 51? Well, the developers of Park 51, who originally was calling the cultural center the Cordoba House or the Cordoba Institute, which was supposed to be a symbol of interfaith cooperation from that 15th century Spain, when the faiths of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all flourished together in Spain during the age of Andalusia. But that name somehow caused controversy because people felt that it was symbolizing what people resistant to this cultural center was saying, was that it was a symbol of Muslim subjugation of the West, you know, from prior times. So the developers changed it to Park 51, and they feel now that this is a name that is very New Yorkish. Park 51, and that the center, of course, is open to all New Yorkers, not just Muslims. But this Park 51 has indeed caused controversy. In this picture, you can see that this is what really the building is now. Right? It's almost, if you look at the top picture, like a hole in the wall. It's actually in an area of New York City that has been abandoned for 9 years. It's in an area where there's really no one. Empty stores, which are still boarded up windows, which still has boarded up windows. But the mosque, or the cultural center that's being built, really, we have to look at some of the facts. It's not just going to be a mosque, as people are calling it, a mosque. It's going to be a community center. And it's supposed to include basketball courts, a culinary school. And as I heard one cable news channel commentator say, really, there aren't going to be any terrorist basketball point guards or chefs in this cultural center. Right? The cultural center is supposed to be 13 stories high. The top two floors are supposed to be dedicated prayer rooms for Muslim worship. Okay. It's not a training center for terrorists. It's not a tribute to medieval subjugation of the West. It's not an insult to victims of 9/11. It's not really on ground zero. It's actually two blocks from the northeasternmost part of the ground zero area. And if you put it in perspective of where they're building the ground zero memorial, it's more like four or five New York City blocks. Right. In fact, there were Muslims who died in the World Trade Center on 9/11 back in 2001. So Muslims were also victims of 9/11, as were Muslims were also first responders to 9/11. But that idea that somehow building this Islamic cultural center or this community culture center in the area near Ground Zero is somehow insulting to the victims of 9/11 is suggesting that American Muslims had something to do with 9/11. When we all know that American Muslims had nothing to do with 9/11, and that across the board, American Muslims in this country have condemned those attacks. But indeed, Muslims were first responders in 9/11. And I'd like to play you a video which actually points just to that.
Everybody was inching closer and closer instead of moving farther away. It just didn't sink in. It didn't. Guys were just crawling under beams, crawling under cars, climbing on top of things. I had a very good friend of mine, named Sean Powell, and he worked in my firehouse for a while. When my friend came up to me and told me that Sean Powell was on the list, I was like, no, he's not. And I took out my phone and I called him. That's really when it hit me. I was like, okay, this is real. That's what hit me. I'm a New York City firefighter, and I responded to 9/11. And I am Muslim.
So this is a public service announcement that was recently made by the Council on American Islamic Relations to try and combat that idea that Muslims were behind 9/11, but in actuality, it's the message that, you know, 9/11 happened to everyone. It was a tragedy even for American Muslims in this country where we were also victims as well as first responders. It's interesting, I read an article recently in the New York Times that actually talks a lot more about that. That Islam and Muslim life was very much part of the World Trade Center before it was toppled. With other churches in that vicinity of Ground Zero, interfaith, religious worship was very much a part of the World Trade Center. And that included Islam both in and around the World Trade Center. Around the World Trade Center first, there was Masjid Muhammad, or the Mosque of, or Masjid Manhattan, the Mosque of Manhattan on Warren Street, which is only 4 blocks from Ground Zero. Inside the South Tower of the World Trade Center on the 17th floor was a Muslim prayer room. Was an area where Muslims can make their daily prayers. In addition to that Muslim prayer room was also a washroom fitted for cleansing the hands, face, and also feet for Muslims who wash before their prayer. And on any given day, you would find in the World Trade Center, in the South Tower, financial analysts, carpenters, secretaries, receptionists, iron workers, American-born, naturalized immigrants who earned their citizenship, visitors, foreign visitors, international visitors, conducting international business inside the World Trade Center, using this prayer room inside one of the towers. Inside the North Tower, between the 106th and 107th floors was an area that was also used daily by Muslims. On the top of that tower, the North Tower, was a restaurant, and it was called Windows of the World Restaurant, which employed several Muslims. So you had Muslim employees, you had waiters, Muslim chefs, Muslim banquet managers and others who use this area in the North Tower to perform their daily prayers. And one of the survivors who had worked in that restaurant said that during Ramadan, that was his favorite time, when the Muslims would celebrate and break their fast at sundown in the employee cafeteria of this restaurant at the top of the North Tower. So Muslim worship, Muslim life, was very much a part of the World Trade Center. And this is something important to know, because this, you know, contradicts this idea that one should be insulted if American Muslims want to build an Islamic center in that area, especially if they own that property. But let me move on to some other aspects. Here's a couple pictures, though, of the community center and actually what it looks like today inside, right? There's actually been worship and prayers being conducted inside the Park 51 facility for the past year or so. And that worship also includes women. But still, nevertheless, we've seen over the last few weeks a tremendous amount of resistance, protests to this cultural center. And perhaps it's because this is an election year. And maybe there are some political reasons why people want to make a big deal out of building a cultural center in the area of Ground Zero rather than talk about the real issues that might be important, like the economy, like healthcare, like our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, like Guantanamo Bay, which is still open today. Okay. So these are all some things that are very relevant today with regard to Islamophobia. This whole controversy over Ground Zero, you know, the mosque in Ground Zero, has led to protests of other mosques around the country that are either being built or being expanded. Here's a protest that was taking place up in Connecticut, or down in Connecticut from here. Hate signs that were left at a mosque in Madera, California. You know, this hate sign said, "No temple for the god of terrorism at Ground Zero." This was left at a mosque in California, 3,000 miles away, referencing Ground Zero. Okay, this is something that was left at a Sacramento Valley area mosque. A toy pig, right, that said, "Remember 9/11. And look what it says underneath. Moham, meaning Mohammed, but pointing out ham, you know, like pork. Because Muslims don't eat pork, you know. Okay. In Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where they're planning to move their Islamic center to a different area because of the growth of the community, started first out with community protests against the Muslim community there. Then it led to vandalism of their sign. As you can see on this sign, it says, "Not welcome." And then actually the other sign is actually split in half. And then it led to arson, where someone actually torched the construction equipment that was on the site being used to develop the new area for the new Islamic center. This is happening all over the country. Protests to Islamic centers being built or being expanded. Very recently, last month, this happened in Seattle, Washington. A Sikh 7-Eleven clerk was assaulted because the guy said, "Look, you're not even American, you're Al-Qaeda, go back to your country." And he assaulted and beat up the clerk. Okay. And he thought so because the Sikh individual was wearing a turban. Right? He's not even Muslim. Okay. So sometimes this can be very violent. Like what happened in New York City, where a passenger got into the back of a cab and asked the driver, "Are you Muslim?" And when this individual from Bangladesh said, "Yes, I'm Muslim," he got his throat slashed. All right. Fortunately, the driver didn't die, and the person was apprehended, charged with a hate crime. But this happened because the individual presumed that this guy was Muslim. "I'm going to slash your throat." Okay. So this is what happens when we have this irrational fear or irrational hostility towards Muslims, towards Islam. And this is something that I talk about from some personal experience. Because in 2003, I was serving as the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, a prison camp where our U.S. military was holding hundreds of Muslim prisoners who were, quote, suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda terrorists. I was the Muslim chaplain assigned to the prison camp to ensure that they had some religious accommodation, to help facilitate communications between these Muslim prisoners and the military. But in my role, in my job, in objecting to the abuses of these prisoners, I then became also looked at as one of the enemy and became targeted. And for standing up for the rights of these Muslim prisoners in Guantanamo and for objecting to the torture and abuse of these prisoners in Guantanamo, I was then myself thrown in jail by my own government, by the U.S. military. I was thrown in prison. I was shackled in a suit of chains at the wrists, the waist, the ankles. I was threatened with the death penalty by military prosecutors. who said they were charging me with spying, espionage, aiding the enemy, mutiny and sedition, which are all capital crimes, right? I was subjected to what's called sensory deprivation, where they put these blackened out goggles over my eyes. They put these devices over my ears so I couldn't hear. I was being treated like what President Bush called enemy combatant. I was thrown into solitary confinement for 76 days, while the news media swirled with headlines that the Muslim chaplain from Guantanamo Bay, a terrorist spy, was apprehended and now on lockdown. That's what happened to me, because people feared who I was because of me being a Muslim, an American Muslim who was standing up for the rights of Muslim prisoners in Guantanamo. Well, I was in jail for 76 days, and actually after 76 days, pretty much it became clear of what I did. And that was essentially object to the abuse of prisoners. That I had committed no crime, that I wasn't a spy, I wasn't a terrorist, I wasn't aiding any enemy. And all of the charges and accusations that were brought against me were quickly dropped. I was released, reinstated as a military chaplain in the U.S. Army. My record was wiped clean. And then I myself would take the next step and resign from the U.S. military, receiving an honorable discharge in January of 2005. And actually, when I separated from the U.S. military, I even received a second U.S. Army Commendation Medal for, quote, exceptionally meritorious service. I received a second U.S. Army Commendation Medal for exceptionally meritorious service after I was accused of being a terrorist spy in Guantanamo Bay. Somehow that doesn't add up to me. But I never received an apology for what I went through. But no doubt my life was turned upside down because I was targeted for my faith and also, I believe, my ethnicity. I do believe my ethnicity played a role in being targeted. I had learned throughout my time in this case that someone had said of me in Guantanamo, quote, "Who the hell does this Chinese Taliban think he is?" Telling us how to treat our prisoners. I was called a Chinese Taliban. Right? They didn't just call me Taliban. They called me a Chinese Taliban. So I assume someone was disturbed that I was of Chinese ethnicity, you know. But that's what can happen, really, when Islamophobia, when you have this irrational fear, when you have this irrational hatred towards another group, lives get turned upside down. People can get assaulted. People get their throats slashed, killed, right? And we lose the value of our country. What value is that? You know, diversity, religious freedom. I mean, when we think about it, the very, very first people to come to the United States, to settle here in the United States from Europe, came for religious freedom. They came to find a place where they could worship freely. Even if they had their own stringent, puritanical view of faith, they wanted a place where they can practice it freely. So they left Europe and they came here to the United States. Our nation was founded on this idea of religious freedom. But today we see this wave of Islamophobia, vandalism of Islamic centers, people, Muslims being assaulted, people who look like they might be Muslim being assaulted, protests against mosques and Islamic centers, and whatnot taking place. And this is something that, in my view, as a community, we have to speak up and speak out against. Why? maybe because of something like what Pastor Martin Niemöller said. He was a German intellectual during the time of the Holocaust. And one of the things he said was, they came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't communist. Then they came for the trade unionists. I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me. And by that time, no one was left to speak up. Right? So what's the message here? We have to speak up. We have to protect the rights that we have in this country. Whether that's religious freedom, justice, diversity. We all have our part to play in establishing and creating the type of nation that we want it to be. Okay. Lastly, I'll leave you with this photo. And I ask at the top, you know, I should be asking instead of stating, is this what is happening to America? And we see this photo, a historic photo, that was taken right here in Boston back in 1976. It's actually won a Pulitzer Prize. It was a protest, an integration protest. And we see this guy using an American flag, what? To take out someone of color. Right. So is this what is happening today with this Islamophobia? I hope not. And I hope it's something that we as a nation, that we as a community can strive past, that we can defeat and continue on a road that establishes a society that is equal and open for people of all faiths, of all colors, of all ethnicities, of all walks of life. With that, I look forward to questions, any comments that you might have about my experience in the military, my experience as an American Muslim, my experience as a chaplain in Guantanamo Bay. With that, again, it's an honor and pleasure to be able to talk with you, to be able to share with you some of my thoughts, my comments, and again, I look forward to meeting many of you and hearing your comments and questions. Thank you very much.